Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue our examination of the assassination of Martin Luther King as presented in a wonderful new book entitled Orders to Kill, subtitled The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. This book was authored by William F. Pepper, P-E-P-P-E-R, published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff and copyrighted 1995. It is, in my opinion, the best individual book about the assassination of Martin Luther King, and I think it is one of the very best books about American political assassinations ever published. In particular, I think this book is very useful because it illustrates, in very convincing and dramatic fashion, just how such seemingly disparate elements as the intelligence community, the military per se, and in particular the United States Army, and organized crime work together in some of these national security-related conspiracies. In our first segment, we examined what I have termed the civilian conspiracy. This was actually just one branch, one could say, of the larger conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King. The actual fatal shot was fired, in all probability, by a civilian organized crime figure with connections to the intelligence community named Raoul, who also was James Earl Ray's handler. That is to say, he was trafficking around James Earl Ray and helping to set James Earl Ray up as the patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King. The civilian contract, as I have termed it, originated with the New Orleans Organized Crime Organization of Carlos Marcello and utilized in Memphis a Memphis produce dealer and organized crime associate of Marcello's named Frank C. Liberto, L-I-B-E-R-T-O, who in turn utilized a fellow named Lloyd Jowers, a gambling associate of his who owed him a tremendous amount of money. Jowers ran Jim's Grill, a restaurant right near the Lorraine Motel, and it was Lloyd Jowers, as it wasn't right near, it was actually directly contiguous to the Lorraine Motel, the rooming house from which James Earl Ray supposedly fired the shot that killed Martin Luther King. In fact, the shot was actually fired from some bushes just outside of Jim's Grill. Lloyd Jowers' role in the crime was to take the weapon that was to be used by Raoul, store it, and then store it after the assassination itself. We took a look at the circumstances, or some of the circumstances, surrounding this civilian branch of the conspiracy. We also took a look at former House Select Committee on Assassinations Chief Counsel G. Robert Blakey's denial that well-known Cleveland-area organized crime figure Mo Dalitz had been involved with organized crime. We also took a look at his alleged threat to Mark Lane, an assassination researcher, basically threatening him with death if he kept up his investigation. We also took a look at the possible teeth behind a threat like that, namely the murder of William Sartor, S-A-R-T-O-R is his last name, a writer for Time magazine who was investigating what I have termed the civilian conspiracy. Now, although the civilian conspiracy, actually just the civilian wing of a huge political and national security establishment conspiracy, was the actual element of this operation that produced the fatal shot that killed Martin Luther King, as we will see, the civilian conspiracy, as William Pepper terms it, was only one branch of a much larger and more significant operation, which involved, among other elements, the United States Army and Army intelligence. As we shall see in just a moment, there were a couple of Green Beret sniper teams in Memphis, Tennessee, operating under the auspices of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, as well as the 20th Special Forces Group, based in Alabama. These teams, part of Alpha Team 184, were in Memphis, Tennessee, with the assignment to kill Martin Luther King. As we shall see, they were the backup in case the civilian sniper, in this case Raoul, missed. By the way, for further background on the assassination of Martin Luther King, and I am not even attempting to relate all of the aspects of that assassination conspiracy, contact Archives on Audio, a tape duplication service that has a type of radio documentary that I've put together over the years called Archive Shows on Permanent File. Those archive shows, as I have termed them, consist of printed information read on the air so that listeners can tape the programs and then use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. All of those archive shows are available from Archives on Audio, along with a 20-page catalog that lists all of the archive shows, cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material, and gives a synoptic account of what is in each program. Archives on Audio can be contacted at P.O. Box 170023, Post Office Box 170023. That's in San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number is 415-346-1840. That's 415-346-1840. In an addendum to Radio Free America program number 8 that was recorded in March of 1994, I read into the record some fascinating information from the Memphis Commercial Appeal from March 21st of 1993, detailing a decades-long U.S. Army intelligence spying program on various black American civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King. And in that particular series of articles, we also looked at information that maintained that a special forces team was actually in Memphis, Tennessee, in connection with the spying operation on Martin Luther King. This account, however, maintained that there was no connection between that special forces team and the assassination. As we shall see, although the special forces team did not fire the fatal shot, they were there specifically to back up the civilian team. We're going to turn next to Orders to Kill, again by William Pepper, hardcover edition Carolyn Graff, copyrighted 1995. And we're going to take a look at the point of interface between Dr. William Pepper's examination. By the way, Pepper was is one of James Earl Ray's lawyers. And we're going to examine how he came across the military connection to the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, again, although the military did not fire the fatal shot that killed Martin Luther King, I think the military backup to this civilian operation is very significant because it not only indicates the methodology involved in American political assassinations, involving, on the one hand, a plausibly deniable, a civilian conspiracy plausibly deniable by the national security establishment, yet at the same time it illustrates, as we shall see, that that conspiracy was originated at the very pinnacle of power in the United States, a pinnacle which could also enlist the support of the military. Of the beginning of the discovery by William Pepper of the military connection to the assassination, the author writes as follows in Orders to Kill. In late July, I widened the focus of my investigation. I met with Steve Tompkins, T-O-M-P-K-I-N-S, the former Commercial Appeal investigative reporter whose front page piece on the active role of Army intelligence since the end of World War I in surveilling and infiltrating black organizations and civil rights groups had been published on March 21, 1993. Army intelligence had spied on Dr. King's family for three generations. The article noted that there was an extraordinary fear in official circles of what would happen if Dr. King was allowed to lead masses of American poor into Washington that spring. It stated that Army intelligence was, quote, desperately searching for a way to stop him, unquote. I wanted to learn whether Tompkins, who had spent 18 months researching his piece, knew anything about the King killing, and if so, whether he could open up some doors for me. Since Dr. King had been under Army surveillance, I wondered if the killing had been seen and even photographed. I had earlier read about this possibility in Douglas Valentine's book, The Phoenix Program, though at the time it appeared to be too speculative. Tompkins, a lanky, guardedly friendly man, had gone to work for the Tennessee Governor's Economic Development Department. I noted that he had confirmed the presence in Memphis that day of a number of Army intelligence operatives. I needed to know their roles and, if possible, who they were. He would not give me their names, but he did offer an observation that surprised and chilled me. He explained that he had stumbled on certain information which he was unable to print because of the lack of corroboration. He said that he had come to believe that in addition to surveilling Dr. King on April 4, 1968, the Army presence in Memphis had a more sinister mission related to the assassination. He had come to this conclusion after a conversation with a former Special Forces soldier now living in Latin America. The nervous ex-soldier had showed up with an AK-47 rifle, which he kept near at hand throughout the interview. This man was the only member of the Army unit whom Tompkins had been able to interview. Another member had been shot in the back of the head in New Orleans. The ex-soldier told Tompkins that he decided to leave the country after one of the members of the unit deployed to Memphis had been killed. He said it appeared that a, quote, cleanup, unquote, operation was underway and that he had better get out. I was at once excited and frustrated because this important information greatly complicated the picture. It was imperative that I investigated as far as I could. Tompkins warned me that if publicly questioned, he would deny telling me the information. As we parted, he said he was relieved to be away from the project, stating, quote, "These people are incredibly dangerous. They'd kill you, your mother, or your kids as soon as look at you. You have to be very careful," unquote. In a subsequent conversation, I asked him if he would take me to his contacts or at least provide me with the names of people involved so that I might seek them out myself. I hoped he would become involved since he himself had been in naval intelligence and so had initial credibility and military access. He also understood far better than I could the mentality of that special community and how they operated. He reluctantly agreed to think about it. And still more about William Pepper's dramatically deepening investigation and the assistance that Stephen Tompkins gave him. Still later, he writes, Pepper that is, "During this time, Steve Tompkins called and left an urgent message. When I returned his call, he said that to his surprise, he had received a telegram from a special forces contact he had previously interviewed, whom I will call Warren, who now lived in Latin America. The message was simply that, quote, he now knew who Dr. William Pepper was, unquote, and that he was prepared to answer any questions I would put to him through Tompkins. Under no circumstances would he meet directly with me. The date he set for the meeting outside of the U.S. was the last weekend in March. Steve Tompkins was willing to go as a consultant and put my questions to Warren, who he said had never lied to him, although on occasion he would refuse to discuss a matter or say that he did not know. Based on what Tompkins had told me about him, I knew that he and his partner, whom I will call Murphy, who lived in the same country but who had never met Tompkins, had vital information. He said that though I would have the names of and personal details about Warren, Murphy, and perhaps others, one of the conditions would be that I agree not to name them. Without that understanding, there could be no cooperation. If I broke my word on this issue, he thought it likely that both of us would be killed. I agreed to the condition, but was unclear on whether I could name any participants who had since died. He said simply, quote, that's your call, unquote. Since he would be working for me, he had no problem with my using his name. He would provide detailed written reports. Through James, I got another lead on the Army's role. He had asked me to contact a private investigator. By the way, James is James Earl Ray, beginning again. Through James, I got another lead on the Army's role. He had asked me to contact a private investigator named Alexander Taylor following a meeting he had had with him some while ago. The former intelligence officer told me he would do what he could to help our investigation and mentioned a telephone discussion he recently had had with the former Army Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, Major General William P. Yarborough. That's Yarborough. Taylor reported that Yarborough believed that it was time for the American people to be told how close America was to civil war during the late 1960s and how extensive was the military preparation. There are a number of things to note here. First of all, note that pseudonyms are used for living members of this Green Beret team, Alpha Team 184, and some of the people connected with it for reasons that should appear only too obvious. The potential degree of hazard for dealing with information like this could not be exaggerated, and it was expressed by Tompkins saying these people are incredibly dangerous. They'd kill you, your kids, or your mother as soon as look at you. By the way, it also is a testimony to the extreme bravery of not only Stephen Tompkins, but William F. Pepper, and also, frankly, the bravery and patriotism and candor of these special forces operatives and other military people who have come forward, even at this length of, at this distance of, in time, because obviously they are exposing themselves to a considerable degree of danger. Note also the name of Major General William P. Yarborough. He was the Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence, or ACSI, and his statement that, or his belief that the American people should know how close the U.S. was to civil war in the late 1960s. Yarborough believed that it was altogether possible that an uprising by militant blacks, possibly in combination with people opposed to the war in Vietnam, could actually have led to civil war. I don't believe that that was a realistic possibility. I do not agree with that analysis. However, it should be noted that there was that type of rhetoric in the air, and this is in no way to be judgmental of Yarbrough or his viewpoint, but I think it is very important to understand that Yarbrough's viewpoint was shared by others in the corridors of power, and that this genuine alarm over what was going on dictated their actions. What those actions were can be seen as follows. Note again that William Yarbrough, as well as other people in positions of power, in particular in the military and military intelligence, believed that with widespread opposition to the war in Vietnam and with a growing and powerful American civil rights movement, some elements of which were quite militant, that there was the possibility of a civil war and widespread unrest in the United States. Martin Luther King, sadly, was viewed by these individuals as a militant leader rather than as the exponent of nonviolence that he was, and consequently as a potential break on that type of activity. That is why he was slain. We're going to return again to the book Orders to Kill by William Pepper, and of Major General Yarbrough and his ascension to the position of ACSI, again Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence. The author writes as follows. Major General Yarbrough took over in December of 1966 as ACSI, again that's Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence, coming from command of the 66th Military Intelligence Group in Stuttgart, where his primary duty was to catch communist spies and run agents in East Germany. A limited number of key officers served under him. The commanding officer of USAINTC, the overall Army Intelligence Organization, was Brigadier General William Blakefield, who was not a trained or experienced intelligence officer, and who seemed to have been chosen for that position by Army Chief of Staff Harold Johnson precisely because he was an outsider. The impression I have formed is that General Blakefield was uncomfortable with this command area, and that he followed the ACSI General Yarbrough on most issues. The director of the CIA at the time was Richard Helms, and J. Edgar Hoover, of course, led the FBI. Though a closely guarded secret, FBI Director Hoover seconded a trusted agent, Patrick D. Putnam, to Yarbrough's ACSI staff in the Pentagon in order to ensure the closest working relationship. Putnam began this assignment in December of 1966 with Yarbrough's arrival and continued after his departure in July of 1968. The commanding officer of the 111th Military Intelligence Group, the group which covered all of the Deep South and so was most often engaged in surveilling Martin King, was Colonel Robert McBride. From 1959 to 1971, the commander of the 20th Special Forces Group was Colonel Henry H. Cobb, Jr., service number 00005143838 of Montgomery, Alabama, who retired as a major general. By the way, the 20th Special Forces Group, a Special Forces Reserve unit based in Alabama, was the group from which Alpha Team 184 was recruited. More about that in a few minutes. The Alabama Army National Guard, which contained the 20th Special Forces Group, was per capita the nation's largest in 1968. Alabama also had the largest number of armories, 140 of any state in America. In 1968, the Alabama Guard operated on a $150 million budget. By the way, it was second in size only to the National Guard contingents from New York and California, and as such, again, the largest per capita. In 1979, after his retirement, Cobb became Alabama Adjutant General, the highest-ranking member of the Alabama Army National Guard, appointed by Governor Fob James. The next segment of Pepper's book deals with what he calls the 20th Special Forces Group professionals. These are the individuals recruited for Alpha Team 184, the special eight-man team that was to kill Martin Luther King if the civilian sniper failed. Bear in mind that many of these names, the names of living members of the team, are pseudonyms. We read, Warren and Murphy, the two members of the Special Forces team deployed to Memphis on April 4th, who had agreed to discuss the mission, had been active in covert Special Operations Group SOG missions in Vietnam. They were hardened, highly skilled veterans. Warren was a sniper. Both were from the 5th Special Forces Group in Vietnam and part of a mobile strike force team involved in cross-border covert operations in 1965 and 66. They were reassigned in 1967 as reservists to the 20th Special Forces Group with Camp Shelby, Mississippi as their training base although they also secretly trained, according to Warren, at Mississippi Senator James Eastland's plantation near Rosedale in Sunflower County. I obtained a copy of the 20th Special Forces Group roster of Alabama soldiers around the time, and their names appeared. There's then a discussion of other domestic intelligence and covert operations engaged in by members of this team. They were deeply involved in the mid and late 1960s with operations vis-a-vis the American Civil Rights Movement. William Pepper writes, Warren and Murphy stated that throughout 1967, they were deployed in 902nd covert operations as members of small, specialized, quote, Alpha Team, unquote, units in a number of cities where violence was breaking out. The 902nd is the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. Continuing, they were issued photographs of black militants in each city they entered, and in some instances, particular individuals were designated as targets to be taken out or killed if an opportunity arose in the course of a disruption or riot. During this time, Army Intelligence published green and white books, or mug bugs, on black radicals, which contained photographs, family history, political philosophy, personal finances, and updated surveillance information in order to facilitate their identification by Army commanders and intelligence personnel. An example given by Warren was his mission in Los Angeles in February of 1968, when there was a major black conference at the L.A. Sports Arena. Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee leaders Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown were there. The 20th Special Forces Group had the arena staked out in case of trouble. Surveillance pictures of a militant black group called the Brown Beret were passed out to the members of the team. The group's borrowing of the Green Beret symbol, quote, pissed all of us off, unquote, Warren said. One target was a man named Karenga, or Ron Karenga, whose organization's headquarters were down on South Broadway near some strip joints. The 20th Special Forces Group had a team across the street waiting for him, but he never showed up. Warren said that on that occasion they also had a secondary mission, which was to do reconnaissance of a home up in the western hills near the UCLA campus. The recon was to determine the feasibility for a future, quote, wet insert ops determined, unquote, operation. Wet insert ops determined means that the unit carries out a surreptitious entry at night into the targeted residence, kills everyone there, and leaves without a trace. He said their recon confirmed the feasibility of such an operation. Warren subsequently learned that the house was used by Senator Robert Kennedy when he was in Los Angeles in 1967 and 68. Shortly after the recon, Kennedy would declare for the presidency. Warren said that in 1967, he was also similarly deployed on other sensitive operations in Tampa, Florida, June 12th through 15th, 1967, riots, Detroit, Michigan, July 23rd, 1967, riot, Washington, D.C., October 1967, riot, and Chicago, Illinois, December of 1967, recon. I would note, too, that although one cannot draw a hard conclusion from this, there is discussion earlier in the book of an organized crime figure with connections to the intelligence community who discussed the impending assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, this shortly after the assassination of Martin Luther King, before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and stated that if Robert Kennedy won the California primary, that he himself was going to be murdered. Of course, he did win the California primary and was murdered that very evening. By the way, interested listeners can access information about the connections between the assassination of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King in a number of different archive shows available from Archives on Audio. Radio Free America number 8 deals with the assassination of Martin Luther King. Radio Free America number 9 deals with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And there's also a four-part archive series dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy entitled The Guns of November. There are numerous other archive shows dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy, and I would strongly recommend that people get a hold of the catalog from Archives on Audio with descriptions of the programs and cross-references. I would note also the reference here to a home in the western hills of Los Angeles near the UCLA campus. That home, of course, is not identified. It is mentioned that the house was used by Senator Robert Kennedy when he came to L.A. in 67 and 68. One thought that occurs to me, and something that I think should be looked into, I doubt it will be, but it should be. And that is that this home may have been the Cielo Drive home that later became infamous when some of the people who lived there and were visiting, namely actress Sharon Tate and some of her associates, were murdered by operatives of the so-called Manson family. In a number of archive shows, including Radio Free America number 12 and a miscellaneous archive series entitled The Ultimate Evil, Satanism, Mind Control, and the U.S. National Security Establishment, we have gone into connections not only between the Manson family and the milieu of the intelligence community, but also between the Manson family and elements of the Aryan Brotherhood, a neo-Nazi prison gang in California, and we've examined information that the Manson family killings may actually have been a provocation intended to alarm the public and make them more conducive to broader police tactics, broader surveillance tactics, reduce civil liberties to combat these psycho hippie killers, quote unquote. We've also noted strong connections between, between individuals involved in prosecuting Saran Saran for the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. He did not kill Robert Kennedy. And the individuals who covered up some of the apparent intelligence connections to the Manson family. We should note that Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate were deeply involved with Robert Kennedy's campaign in the Los Angeles area, and that the statement had apparently been made by Robert Kennedy that after he was elected president, he would reopen the investigation into his brother's murder. This in the presence, apparently, of Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. One of the possibilities that I think should be seriously considered is that the recon performed by this Special Forces Group team, this particular Special Forces Group team, members of which were later involved with the Memphis operation, may very well have been a recon of the Cielo Drive home, and that ultimately their recon was put into operation when in fact there was a wet insert ops determined. All of the people in that home were ultimately killed, and the killers left, at least initially, without a trace. By the way, I would note, too, that an individual with very strong intelligence connections named Ed Butler, an individual who was involved with an organization called the Information Council of the Americas, an intelligence front, Ed Butler had been very much involved with setting up Lee Harvey Oswald's appearance on WDSU in New Orleans, in which Oswald stated that he was a communist. This recording was played all over the United States the day of the evening of President Kennedy's assassination. Note that Ed Butler was present at a news conference in Los Angeles, held by some extreme right-wingers with connections to that particular investigation, meaning the investigation of the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Ed Butler had gone to work for Patrick Frawley, who was a member of Ronald Reagan's so-called kitchen cabinet. He was also, that is to say, Frawley was also affiliated with the American Security Council, a far-right-wing think tank with evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of Third Reich alumni working with our intelligence system. And Ed Butler, again writing for the Aware magazine put out by Patrick Frawley, discussed the killings, the Tate-LaBianca killings, and said this was obviously the work of black militants such as the Black Panthers. The word pig had been scrawled in blood on the walls. As we will see, this particular piece of disinformation by Ed Butler is in keeping with the viewpoint that was held in the corridors of power in this country at that time, that the Black Power movement and the American Civil Rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement, showing areas of overlap, could not only become a threat to the so-called establishment, but could even lead to a possible civil war. We will discuss that at greater length in subsequent segments. People interested in hunting down book titles in this line of work, in this discipline, I should say, should contact Antifa Book Service, A-N-T-I-F-A Book Service. They are located at 945 Taravel Street, T-A-R-A-V-A-L Street, number 117 in San Francisco. The zip code is 94116. Again, Antifa Book Service, 944 Taravel Street, number 117, San Francisco, California. We will continue with our analysis of the military intelligence connections to the assassination plot against Martin Luther King's life in our next segment. That concludes this segment, however. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.